Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to another episode of Talking About Platforms. This is Philip Meyer. I have with me my co-host Tommaso Buganza, and we have with us Tobias Kretschmer, who is a professor of management, the head of the Institute for Strategy, Technology and Organization at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich. That's right. How it is. Hello, Tobias. Welcome to Talking About Platforms.
Hi, Philip. Hi, Tommaso. Thanks very much for having me.
Great to have you.
So the first thing that we would like to ask you is basically the same thing that we ask everybody joining this podcast. So we are sharing a sort of passion and interest for platforms, but how did you get to it? So what happened that at a certain point made you, you know, become a scholar, a researcher, a passionate person about platforms?
It's a fantastic question. And I keep on telling anyone who wants to know or doesn't want to know that I basically was researching platforms before they even existed. Now, why do I say that? I did my PhD in the late 90s and early 2000s, and I basically worked on network effects. So I worked on direct and indirect network effects. And I thought this was super cool and this was super interesting. I kept on going and kept on working on that. And then at some point, people started talking about this platform thing. And I said, well, platforms are really just combinations of goods and services that have direct network effects and that have indirect network effects. So I tried to educate them for a while that really platforms are nothing special. But then I slowly woke up to the fact that platforms are indeed something that's a bit separate from just goods with network effects. And then I kind of got a bit more deeply into that. And before you know it, I became a platform researcher.
Yeah, so we typically also open with the question, what is a platform for you? This is a typical opener for all our guests. But for you, Tobias, we would like to dedicate a bit more of the episode to this question, because I think you have a very interesting perspective. And quoting from one of your papers, you define platforms as meta-organizations, and you say that they are less formal and less hierarchical structures than firms, and yet more closely coupled than traditional markets.
Absolutely. And that's exactly how I think of platforms, really. I mean, obviously, if we think of a platform ecosystem, it's an organizational form. That organizational form is special because it has some actor that actively manages a set of more actors, of independent actors, which is, you know, again, what you might have in a more standard market, in which the whatever the agency managing the transactions would be the managing part, or in a firm where, of course, the firm forms contracts, right? So they organize contracts. I think what's special on platforms is that the secondary actors, or what we call complementers, those complementers make up for a significant part of the value that's created by the platform, right? So without complementers, the platform itself has no value. And I think that's really what's interesting about this. And I think that really is what sets those kinds of meta organizations apart from both hierarchies and markets.
I was thinking, this is fascinating. So this idea of, being able to manage an external, you know, set of complementers who are basically producing a large part of the value, and partially also capturing part of the value. So that's the reason why they want to say that. And I was thinking, is there any specific kind of competence that would be peculiar of these platforms in order to make them able to do this? So something that is not normal in a linear value chain company, and instead turns to be incredibly important if you want to be this kind of orchestrator of external mm-hmm. complementers.
Mm-hmm. So I think maybe there's I mean, let me kind of answer in a slightly roundabout way. I think what a platform orchestrator needs to be able to do is basically achieve two things. The first, they need to get people through the door, meaning they need to get them to sign up to platform, to be kind of to join the platform, right? And then the second part is they need to get them to participate, and to participate in a way that creates value for all the participants on the platform. And so those are two, of course, two very interlinked abilities, or two very closely interlinked things that need to happen, that in many cases you don't actually need so much, either if you're looking at a firm or if you're looking at a hierarchy, right? So a hierarchy will typically think less of the need to attract participants that may or may not be active, but their main concern is about getting people active, right? So this is how incentives work. This is how job descriptions work, because you want to make sure that these that your employees, your suppliers, and so on perform to specification. On the other hand, if you think of a market, basically you want lots of people who are able to perform these transactions. So this is very much more about the having people through the door, having people as potential transaction partners. The transaction itself on a market is typically a lot simpler, right? So these will not be repeat interactions. These will not be repeat transactions, but rather you want to make sure that the market is as thick as possible. And so in platforms, you kind of have the best of both worlds, or you have the worst of both worlds, because of course there's a trade-off between those two. Right. So this is something that I've actually been looking at in one of my first platform papers, where we looked at the how easy are you going to, or how attractive are you going to make it for developers of apps. That was back on in Facebook, in the Facebook world, basically. So how attractive is it for someone who develops an app to produce a high quality app? Right. And so there you needed incentives, because you wanted as many, or you wanted high quality apps. On the other hand, if you make it too hard for people to develop high quality apps, you're going to see a shrink in numbers. And you want, at the same time, you want enough apps, you want enough complements. But on the other hand, you also want high quality apps. And so there, you basically are trading off constantly that participation and the contribution constraint.
From the perspective of the meta organization, based on your research in the field, I see that often the platforms also occupy complementary roles, and there's often a set of services that could be a complementary service, but it also can be a core feature of the platform, so to say. So it's in between the worlds, right? How does that fit into this? Where's the difference between it is a complement and it is a feature, and then we have the meta organization? How can I make sense of these different concepts?
Yes, so I mean that sort of refers to this whole idea of platform envelopment, right? So this idea that you get the platform doing increasingly what the complementers used to do, and you bring that into the platform. That principle is actually quite old, right? So if you think of Microsoft's operating system, there was a big scandal when they basically saw that something was going well, right? media software, internet browsers, and so on. And then they actually, you know, it was a nice sleight of hand. They basically said, oh, actually, we believe that this is part of the operating system. And then they just included it in the operating system. So that's exactly that idea of platform development. Again, before people were talking about platforms. Maybe at a slightly broader level, we can think of this as first-party complements. Right. So these are produced by the platform itself, and they are clearly complementary to the baseline service of the platform itself. So if we think of this in the context of the quantity quality trade-off, it almost seems like there's no trade-off. Right. I can decide as a platform, I can decide how many complements I will want to produce myself. So I can choose the quantity. And I can decide how much I want to spend on developing or how much effort I want to exert on developing these complements. So I can also choose the quality. Now, where is the problem? The problem is I think twofold. First of all, it's, I think, understood that typically the most lively platforms will not consist purely of first-party complements, right? Imagine your phone, your iPhone, with just the Apple apps, right? Apple cannot produce, they cannot develop as many apps as you have consumers that have very different interests. So at some point, that first party complement idea is going to run out of steam, and you're not going to achieve that anymore. Now, then still, why don't we produce as many first-party complements as possible? Because by offering first-party complements, you're going to actually make things worse for third-party complementers, right? And so you're sort of crowding out third-party complementers. And that can be a bad thing because, of course, you are relying on them putting in discretionary effort, putting in their entrepreneurial spirit, their entrepreneurial ideas into developing something that benefits both them and benefits the platform. I'm not going to design a computer game if I think that all the revenues are going to go to Halo, owned by Microsoft, right? I'm not going to design for the Xbox. So it's kind of there where also the specificity of a platform ecosystem becomes so interesting, because you cannot do it all yourself. So the whole old idea of vertical integration to control quality just basically goes out the window, because you're never going to achieve as much value as you need.
Well, I completely see what you're saying. Of course, you need to nurture the ecosystem, and you need to make them profit out of the platform. On the other side, I was thinking, is there any difference if you got competing platforms on the field? Because when you are, so you made the example of the Xbox versus PlayStation, it could be Android versus iOS. So in the moment in which you need to convince somehow customers, final customers, to jump on your platform, you need to have some, once upon a time, they were called killer applications. You need to have some very high quality products to be delivered along with the platform. So I think that this is creating a sort of trade-off. On the one side, you don't want to shrink too much the possibilities for your complementers, but on the other side, you want to be sure that you've got the best quality apps on your platform. And I see that there is a lot of risk for platform owners here, because if you push too much, you can win yourself, but you lose the community and the other way back.
No, I completely agree. I mean, the whole idea of blockbuster apps or blockbuster games that, you know, to some extent benefit the platform itself, but they also can build the market. They can also create the market for other kind of follow-up games or apps or complements. This is something that is extremely, extremely important, extremely relevant, right? So yes, I completely agree with you. I think this is also part of a project that I'm working on with Alex Ruzikov, who's a PhD student at my institute. So we're looking at the use of first-party complements at different stages in the platform lifecycle, right? And what we find is that essentially in the early stages, first party compliments have sort of a market building function, right? So I introduce first party compliments in areas that I may not be very strong in areas where my rival platform may be very strong, because I want to sort of push against my disadvantages. Over time, that market building effect actually disappears somewhat. And then we start saying, well, actually, this, you know, ego shooters are a massive niche in my on my platform. What am I going to do? I'm going to release an ego shooter myself, basically to withdraw or to collect some of the rents, some of the revenues, some of the value that's being created by that niche, right? So you get the harvesting effort or the harvesting benefits later on, and you have the market building efforts in the early stages of the life cycle.
I think the whole Amazon basics discussion is also something very, very related, right? And there I wonder, because it also has the, as you described it, it has a benefit to a consumer if a platform can use the information where the pure market mechanisms fail and step in. But on the other hand, the platform can use the same information to understand where it can compete with a competitive advantage with the first party complementers, right? So what is a potential way to really address this in your opinion?
Well, I mean, your example of Amazon Basics kind of reminds me of Feng Zhu's paper, which looks at Amazon and looks at the likelihood of entering certain market niches. And there it's pretty clear that the benefit to Amazon was essentially, you know, skimming off some of the rents of a market or of a market niche that was being very, very profitable, right? So I think that's pretty, it's pretty clear in that case. How do we address that? From what perspective, if I may ask, what do you mean?
A question would be like from a regulatory perspective, maybe, right? So that would be the first one that comes to mind. So could one think about reducing this information advantage as a potential way to get closer to solving that situation, or are there other that you're particularly looking into or interested in?
So that's cool. I was hoping you were going to ask for the regulatory perspective, because I think that's I have some opinions about that. So, you know, you can think of two regulatory responses. So when Google was found to basically self-preference some search results, they were basically mandated to show a number of non-Google search results before they would show their own result, right? So whatever benefits them. And that's, I think it's completely understandable. It's a way of solving that issue. It's a way of solving that that problem, or addressing the problem of self-referencing. But at the same time, it also feels like a pretty heavy-handed and in some sense a pretty arbitrary regulatory intervention, right? So why three results? Why not five results? Why not one result, right? That's one aspect, and I can think of, you know, you can think of many other possibilities. I think they were even I think you needed to mark the ones that were self-preferenced and so on. So these are all kind of design changes that, you know, some of them may work, some of them may not work. I'm not sure how much they actually address the issue of the economic incentives to self-preference or to use information to your advantage, right? And so there, the other regulatory approach might be one that's more in the direction of trying to, as you say, reduce the information asymmetries between the platform itself and between potential complementers, right? And there's been discussions recently about you know, consumers owning their own data, them being able to transport them somewhere so they don't feel as beholden to wherever they wherever they have data. The idea of actually being able to have your data managed by a data broker to some extent, right? So this is also interesting because those data brokers, at I'm sure a fee of some sort, but those data brokers would actually be mechanisms to reduce that information asymmetry, right? You want to compete with Amazon? We've got the data. We've got all the data that Amazon has for, you know, a certain price, and that's going to put you at an even keel with Amazon. That's a slightly different, I would say, economically, it's a different approach because there you're trying to get at the economic incentives or at the economic mechanisms that lead to self-preferencing, and you're kind of trying to work these out.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, all of this discussion that you got about regulations. So we got the DSA, the DMA, which is, you know, which are heavily discussed in this period, at least here in Europe. And what we know is that there is also a very big difference between different approaches. So if you compare the typical approach of the United States, is, you know, is less focused on the regulatory element. And so what impact do you expect this to have on the growth of existing platform and new platforms? Because it seems that once you got to that place in which you got a sort of advantage, so we are talking about Amazon, we can talk about Google, Apple, so just name them, it seems that it's going to be very difficult to attack them. I mean, probably something will happen in the future, but they seem to be very difficult to be attacked today. And on the other side, what is normally seen in the United States is that the reason why they are able to grow with this incredible, you know, ability and innovate with this speed is just because they do not have too much regulation. On the other side, it seems that the regulation might help you know, newcomers to go into a fair competition. It's this is a very difficult call. So what is actually benefiting more the innovation? Which kind of effort, which kind of attitude? What do you think?
I've been with actually a professor of computer science or information systems and a professor of law. We were thinking about that topic, and we tried to kind of write it up in one way or another. And what came out of this is the idea of having regulation that's resilient. Now, what do I mean by that? You can either be very specific in your regulation, and you can be, you know, extremely specific. You're going to basically make a regulatory set of rules for search engines. Okay, you could call this Lex Google, or you could say it's on search engines, and, you know, all future search engines that work in a similar way will have to follow these rules. Okay, that's very specific. But who on earth knows if in 3 years' time, or in 5 years' time, or even 2 years' time, we're going to be searching in the same way, and they're going to basically use the same kind of technology as it's currently being used, right? So in that case, this might be a regulation that is super efficient, super, super effective for a very specific case, but it's not very resilient because, of course, it's going to be out of date very quickly, right? The other one is you try to really get at the high-level mechanisms, right? How do we use data? How do we govern transactions and so on? And then you kind of come up with a very abstract set of rules that is likely to persist over years, over decades, over many generations of the technology. But if that happens, right, then you're going to have to basically still find a way of matching the general principles with every single particular or specific case at hand. And so we believe that the truth, as always, lies somewhere in the middle. And what we want to find is kind of what are the principles of what essentially is resilient regulation, right? So how can you make what should you look for if you wanted to make regulation more resilient and therefore more persistent over time?
What I've been wondering about for a while is that in markets, traditional markets that are not steered or orchestrated by a platform, there typically are some mechanisms where, be it suppliers or actors who want to bring something into the market and actors who want to demand something in the market, that they organize in some way or the other to centralize a bit more market power. I think the whole antitrust regulation happened to avoid this and to protect the consumer as the smallest individual unit. While if I think about a classical organization, the same happens where the employees form unions to also try to build a counteracting body to have more power. While in meta organizations, there's basically nothing like that happening, right? Is it a feature of the platform, or very, very little? I see very, very little situations where, for example, Uber drivers form something similar like a union, where they try to increase their weight and their interest towards the meta organization Uber. While in a taxi business, it's pretty common that you have taxi drivers forming a union. So is this a feature of a platform to try to actively manage their power position, or what's your opinion on that?
That's a great question. At the risk of oversimplifying, I would think that even in traditional industries, if the pace of innovation is very high, then you're going to see less of those attempts to basically kind of form a counterpart. You know, this goes back to some extent to Schumpeter's creative destruction, right? So if we constantly innovate, who knows if I need to still care about, I don't know, Mercedes-Benz when, you know, next generation, it's all going to be Tesla, right? So in some sense, the pace of innovation is going to determine to what extent you can form a counterbalance. And I think it's no different on platforms, right? And I think that given that many of those hyper-scaled platform business models are fairly new, there still have been very fast-paced innovations and fast-paced changes in business models, in ways of consuming and so on, that it's been fairly tough to form a counterbalance to that. Now, let me give you two counterexamples here. One counterexample, we all know about Epic. We all know about Fortnite and Epic and how this became the biggest thing ever, right? And then they started basically forming a counterpart to Apple, forming a counterpart to Android, because they said, guys, we're not having this anymore. We're not happy with the deal we're getting. And so what you see, my co-authors, Hakan Özalp and Joost Rietveld and I are working on a project there. What you see is that actually the complementer starts taking over more and more functions that used to be done by the platform. So we think of this as reverse envelopment, right? So we've got envelopment and now we've got reverse envelopment. And I think this is a clear function of the fact that these markets are maturing in some sense, and they're maturing on both sides of the market, right? So if you look at the apps market, if you look at the computer games market, it's actually interesting how it becomes surprisingly concentrated, given we think of those games and complements as sort of that these tiny plucky competitors. They're not necessarily. They're all parts of big families of apps or big families of game developers, and they will of course have significant counter market power. Other example is Upwork, right? So that platform for online labor, basically an online labor market. Again, you would think that these are freelancers, and you and I can join Upwork and, you know, take a job, and you're basically being negotiated down to your reservation wage because you have no market power. over the years, what has happened is that there was an increasing trend towards agencies actually representing individual freelancers. Why is that happening? I guess also to kind of, on the one hand, bundle, to kind of be a platform on a platform, but also to build a counter market power to the platform itself, right? And I think these things are happening. I mean, I was just I had just recently read a paper on Spotify and the big major labels, the big major music labels. There again, who really has the power? Is it Spotify squeezing squeezing Universal, or is it the other way around, right? Who needs who more? And I think that's really another interesting bit, where you have these bilateral monopolies or bilateral oligopolies, let's say, where the market power is not nearly as clearly distributed as we would have expected, you know, judging from 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
I think the cases are very different. I mean, if you think about Uber, or you think about, Upwork, at the beginning you had on the complementary side a large amount of small players, and then they decided to team up somehow. In the case of Spotify, it's different because they started by, actually the power at the beginning was exactly in the hands of somebody else. So they seem to be two different starting points to get to a very similar ending position. And I think this is very fascinating. So how the power is actually flowing through the different actors. So now we named the platform owner and the complementers. It might be also, at least theoretically, to the clients. I mean, it could go in different directions. And I was thinking, and I really don't have an idea about this, so let's see if you've got one, that many, many, many years ago, talking about one of the first platforms, and, you know, at the beginning of everything, when we had IBM creating a sort of architecture, and then we had different complementers working on it. So we had Microsoft and Intel. And at a certain point, all of a sudden, nobody was expecting it. The power went all of a sudden from IBM to Microsoft and Intel. So that might be something that we need to understand more and better, because probably it's going to happen more and more in the future.
I completely agree. I used to use the IBM example of the wedge between value creation and value capture, right? So there is absolutely no doubt that IBM created a truckload of value, right? With their ecosystem. Did they capture a lot of that value? Not really, right? So they had, if you think of a computer system having three big components, the operating system, the processors, and the peripherals. Operating system, they outsourced to one firm. Computer chips, they outsourced, again, pretty much to one firm. The peripherals, they decided, well, this is not so important. Let's just make it a commodity. So really, IBM gave away sort of the three elements that are needed to create the value of the overall system. So I am completely with you there.
And I think it's fascinating because at that time, nobody was expecting it. But now I can imagine that we as researchers, we can actually try to understand what is defining the real source of power in a complex ecosystem. And to the best of my knowledge, I didn't see any good study about this yet. So probably somebody is researching it, but I didn't see anything, peculiar so far.
So maybe not at a kind of at a very abstract level, but when I was guest editing the SMJ special issue on platform ecosystems, I think a number of things surprised me a lot. At a macro level, what surprised me is that there were a lot of qualitative studies, essentially, following the process of a platform developing over time. Right. And I think that was a true eye opener. I mean, my heart bleeds numbers. So, this was a big surprise to me, and a big learn, learning experience. And then, you know, to be very specific, so Said Kanaga and Shaz Ansari and Luciano Oviedo did this really nice paper on Cisco and how Cisco basically went from being a central player in one platformy ecosystem to a peripheral player in the next generation of the ecosystem, and then sort of try to find their role, right? They try to find their role in that new world, in that new ecosystem. And I think that's in part it tells us something about how flexible firms need to be. Number one, and the other thing it tells us is that really things can flip, right? Things can flip in markets that develop very quickly. Right.
Looking at this from an organizational perspective, having you, Tobias, here with us as an expert in organizations and organizational structures, when I think about the platform, even if I think about it as a meta organization, like having characteristics from a market, having characteristics from a more traditional hierarchical organization, there always is some kind of traditional organization that builds the technology, defines the governance. What can we learn about this organization itself? So are there some structures, are there some capabilities maybe these organizations typically have that promote like building and running something like a platform into or evolving into a meta organization? Or is this just so diverse that you can have a very, very hierarchical organization that runs a very, very open two-sided market? Or do we see some, let's say, commonalities affecting each side of this equation?
Not an easy one, eh? I mean,
you mentioned the innovation part, right? Being an organization that can really have a high pace of organization requires some structures and some capabilities, no question.
Right, correct, yes. I mean, I would, you know, it may sound like a bit of a cop-out, but I would probably say that the organizations that form kind of the core of platforms can be extremely different. I think they can be extremely different, and they are. And they may very well have very different business models and very different levels of profitability, right? So think of Netflix and Spotify from the outside. Geez, they aggregate content and they're really good at recommending stuff to people, right? Their profitability is very different, and the way they're organized is very different. So I'm not sure if I would actually kind of go from an organizational point of view. I would probably not say a successful platform has to be organized in a certain way, or they all tend to be organized in a certain way. What I do think, though, is that compared to traditional organizations interacting with the outside world in a traditional way, they tend to be cheerleaders much more than taskmasters. Right. So they really need to they need to cajole. They need to make sure that the ecosystem stays lively. It stays dynamic. Right. So to some extent, let's take another app example or another games example. Right. So if Apple had realized that Angry Birds is going like crazy, right? It's a wonderful game. Everyone plays it, right? What would be the kind of the standard reaction of a traditional firm? Oh, let's buy Rovio, right? Or let's sign them up on a long, long-term contract. I'm basically contracting them to develop Angry Birds, really Angry Birds, truly Angry Birds, pissed off birds, and so on and so forth, right? So you would basically want to make sure that they continue doing the same thing. Not on a platform, right? People people want different stuff. People want new stuff. And if that's the case, you want to leave the space for Rovio disappearing, Rovio changing their focus from Angry Birds to something completely different, right? Or from another game, another way of passing your time to take that place, right? Fortnite, just as an example. And so I think those are very different ways of managing. And to be successful as a platform, you need to realize A, that this is a different game, right? It's a different way of managing. And then you need to be good at playing that new game, that other game, which is really much more about leaving freedom to participate for complementers and then freedom to choose a direction for the complementers, right? So that freedom of engagement, the direction and the intensity of engagement. At the same time, a successful platform will still retain some discretion on changing the rules of the game. This is partly related to what I just said about, you know, cajoling and you know, encouraging rather than dictating. But it also means that the platform, what worked for the platform a year ago may not work anymore, right? And this is something that they need to have the discretion to actually change. So if I may, this reminds me of my very first platform paper, which was on those Facebook apps, where there were hundreds and thousands of apps that kept on appearing on Facebook, but many of them weren't very good. And especially many of them sent out notifications. So your feed on Facebook was full of notifications saying that, you know, Philip and Tommaso have been playing Farmville for the last 7 days in a row, and they think you should play too, right? And so you get all these notifications that all your friends are playing a certain game. Of course, Philip didn't send me a message proactively, but it was the algorithm that basically did this. This annoyed people. And so what Facebook did is they said, well, we're going to reward the apps that actually have a fairly high click-through rate of those notifications, right? So this gave them an incentive to, on the one hand, write engaging notifications, and second, make sure that those notifications would then lead to installs, to new app installs, to get people engaged, right? And this was a change in the rules that clearly meant that from a quantity game, they wanted to move more towards a quality game. If you don't have that, if it's all kind of an open system where none of the rules are dictated or can be set by the platform itself, then the platform can rise and can fall just as quickly.
I think this is a very very interesting point, and I experienced something similar right now on LinkedIn, where it also seems that many notifications don't lead me anywhere or don't add any value. So I think LinkedIn is a few years behind when it comes to the incentive structures to guide this.
I agree. Yes. I mean, there may well be a lot of kind of empty recommendations or empty notifications that the algorithm somehow thinks you might be interested in. But yes.
Probably this is linking back to the beginning of this interview, because actually you said that you started from network externalities, and the switching from the quantities to the qualities. Typically, network externalities are seen as completely based on quantities. The more you got, the best. And instead, what we see is that all these platforms, at a certain point, when they reach a sort of critical mass, they need to switch the strategy. Otherwise, it's just too much.
Yes.
It's everything is linking back.
Yes. No, I think that's completely true. This idea of reaching a critical mass is super relevant. I often used to link killer apps and critical mass, because basically you don't actually need 2,000 games. You need a game that is played by 2,000 people, right? So you need the killer app. You need a certain number of killer apps that is going to keep people engaged. maybe what's interesting when it comes to things like social media, when it comes to many of the platforms we're currently thinking of, is that the kind of dominance and engagement has a very short half-life, right? So what was a good search result today may not necessarily be a good search result 4 weeks from now or 1 year from now, right? What is an engaging app today? I don't know, what's a good step counter today may not be the best step counter in the future. What passes the time for me, if I'm on the tube going to work, I will probably do that for a week or two, and then after that I'm going to do something else. So this means that that you need that constant renewal. So in some sense you're forced to constantly renew that critical mass, right? So it's not enough having Angry Birds at some point. You need the next killer, right? You need the next interesting app, the next interesting way of passing time for your users.
Tobias, we started the conversation with you sharing how you started to study platforms and network effects before you were so aware that this is a is a big topic, or is going to become a big topic. We talked about the role of complementers, first level, second level, or tier complementers, the role that platforms play when it comes to offering their own services and incentivizing third parties. We talked about regulation, and we now talked about governance and organizational structures of the platform owners, so to say. So we touched many topics. I think this was a very, very interesting conversation, that's for sure. But what you also mentioned were some projects that you are working on right now. And to close the discussion, we are always also asking our guests what you see on the horizon, what is upcoming, what excites you at the moment about the topic and in the future.
Yeah, so as I was speaking, I realized I'm basically, cutting off my my own legs. So I talked about this idea of reverse envelopment, which I'm terribly excited about right now. And this is a project that I think is just, it's just interesting in so many dimensions. It's relevant, it's theoretically fascinating. For me, it's a completely new way of thinking about a problem, right? As I said, I often work with big data sets. This is going to be a case of epic. So that's I think one of the projects I'm very excited about. The role of first party complements that I'm working on with Alex Rusakov, again, is something that currently I think is extremely hot. I don't think it's been researched to the fullest extent. There's been studies here and there, but I don't think by a long shot that this has been done enough. I think one aspect that I haven't talked about, which I also think has a lot of potential, is how to basically get the platform off the ground. And I see this very much as a kind of as a project or as a field where we probably know a lot qualitatively. We all have sort of a rough idea, you need to get both sides on board and how you're going to do that and so on. But I think that a high quality quantitative study tracing a platform from its very start, right? Or from when it's very small, I think this would be something that would be extremely fruitful. Again, I'm working with Chris Poikert from Lausanne on a platform that is currently thinking through different strategies to seed the platform, right? So how do you get these different market sides? And this is all very well from the point of view of the Apple ecosystem, where you've got half the world on the one side and you've got all the developers on the other side. Yes, you can fine-tune a little bit. If you are a platform and nothing on either side, that problem becomes a lot more interesting, and it becomes a lot more nuanced, and there's a lot more space for experimentation and so on. So this is another project I'm currently working on, and we need to get going on this, but I think it's a super interesting question as well that I haven't seen answered before.
I'm super curious to read and learn more about all the three topics that you lined out. And last question before we close. I am sure the listeners are very curious to learn more and stay up to date as well. Because what's the best channels to follow your work, or maybe also get in touch in case someone wants to.
I think generally I try to, of course, get my stuff published. So when it's published, it's I'm often sick of it, but that's the way the cookie crumbles. I'm very happy for actually people who are interested in platform research to come and visit us in Munich, because what we have tried to do, and I'm aware this is a bad pun, but we've tried to kind of build an ecosystem around platform research at my institute at LMU, and we have a constant stream of visitors coming through, there, I think we've in the past had amazing people come and speak to the amazing local crew that is working on many of those topics. So I think that's something that I really want to establish as a hub for people to come and spend a couple of weeks there.
All right. Thank you so much, Tobias, for your time.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Perfect.
It was great. Thanks.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms.
You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.